This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. We'd live the life we choose. We'd fight and never lose.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Right now, we're with Bea Belosser, who's the author of a book that just came out called Vaccines and Bayonets. It's a historical memoir about fighting smallpox in Africa amid tribalism, terror, and the Cold War. Hi, Bea.
Hi, Tom.
I'm so glad to meet you in person. You're
a
legend
exciting.
Now in my mind. I could not put your book down. It was just captivating and riveting. And you have a deft way as a storyteller of talking to someone in a casual, conversational way.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. And thanks for having me on your show.
My pleasure. Your late husband, Carl, was involved in the CDC in an attempt to eradicate smallpox worldwide.
A successful attempt.
Yeah, yeah. That's double incredible. Now we just need to replicate that today with the new germ.
Yeah, to date, smallpox is the only human disease that has ever been globally eradicated.
And yet it was touch and go for a while, wasn't it? You'd think you had it stomped out and then like another fire would start up. So when you guys left America, your first assignment was in Nairobi?
No, Kano, Nigeria.
And that's where the Biafran connection came in?
Yes, Nigeria was in the middle of the Nigerian Civil War at that time, commonly known as the Nigeria-Biafra War. We were not near the war zone because we were in the north. Of course, the effects of it, impacted the nation.
Yeah, and this is what, 1970?
1969 is when we moved there.
And so at that time, your husband Carl was involved with what is now CDC, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was in the U.S. Public Health Service, working with Indian Health Service and so on. And then he and I had always wanted to go overseas when the West African Smallpox Eradication Measles Control Program became available through CDC, then eagerly jumped on board.
And you guys relatively had no fear. I mean, you packed up your two little kids. How old were they, like three or?
Our son was four.
Four, okay.
And our daughter was 18 months.
Tell us a little bit more about your first duty station and what you guys did.
Well, in Kano, everything was fascinating to me. People talk about culture shock. For me, I just devoured everything. Everything was wonderful, exciting. But there were a lot of tragedies, too.
Right. A real disconnect from a Midwest upbringing, right?
Oh, yes, from small-town Oklahoma. There were three things that were hardest to see in northern Nigeria. One was, of course, the smallpox and the leprosy, the effects of disease, and severely maimed people, some with almost no limbs left. And the other was that women and girls were denied education. Many of them were. There were a few, if they came from a family where the father was in favor of girls being educated, then they could be in school. They had their own separate schools. So there were a few who were being educated. But many were isolated behind walls. And that was a hard thing to see.
In your journey, fascinated by your guys' first duty station, but even more so when you relocated to Equatorial Guinea. Your description of that place geographically on the earth, you paint a picture of this tropical paradise. And yet, what a disconnect in so many ways. Tell us about going there and the learning curve.
Well, when we got the brochures and all of the advance material from the State Department about this transfer to Equatorial Guinea, was just, oh, wow, like a Hollywood set. Oh, it's beautiful. That's just going to be...
Looks like Tahiti, right?
Yes. Yeah. And the brochures describe the warm and friendly people and the waters teeming with fish and all of these things.
Which and it was and had been.
It had been, yeah. Yes. And then we arrived in a place that was a paradise facade. Mm-hmm. And underneath, the warm and friendly people were no longer allowed to have any contact with foreigners at all.
And this was a very recent shift in the culture there.
Yes.
When you guys arrived.
Yes. Equatorial Guinea had been independent for only 18 months at that time.
And it was under Spanish colonial rule before then.
Correct.
So they're very much... Spanish architecture and
yes,
language.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, Franco's Spain was the colonial power, and Equatorial Guinea had been independent only 18 months at that time. Mm-hmm. And the person who won the first presidential election, no one thought could possibly win the election. It was said later by some of their own people that when that election took place, many people did not know what a vote was. And now they would never need to know.
Right, right. And this guy, what his full name again?
Francisco Macias Nguema.
Uh-huh. And he had shades of Idi Amin, right?
Some historians say that he, in some ways, he was even worse than Idi Amin or Pol Pot.
By your description, I would agree with that. I mean, that guy was consummate evil.
It was such a tragedy for the people there. Obviously, a pretty challenging place to to live and work.
You were in the midst of that, of having people, neighbors, disappeared and never surface again.
Well, people did disappear because we weren't able to have any contact with the local people. We didn't really know we would hear about, you know, this person or that person
right.
who had disappeared.
And part of it was the fear of the local people themselves, petrified to engage in conversation with you and Carl.
Yes.
Because they would get taken away, right?
Exactly.
Just because they talked to you being a foreigner.
Right. They would even cross the street to avoid passing us on a sidewalk. And the sidewalks, the streets were almost empty.
Because people that were fearful to just go outside. Right?
Yes. So that was a really strange thing when you're used to all the drums and the rhythms of hearing the singing and the drumming and the... just sounds of life, and to be in an African place where there is just such silence in the streets and almost empty streets, and then the few people who would be on the streets would cross the street even sometimes to avoid passing near us and having any chance that someone would accuse them of interacting, even making eye contact with a foreigner. So,
yeah, but even square one, day one, I remember reading your belongings, your possessions were strewn on your front lawn and soldiers are bayoneting your boxes.
Yes.
That must have been spooky.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was. It definitely was. Seven soldiers inside our living room with their bayonets ramming them into the boxes of things. I still have family photo albums that have
spear marks in them.
Yes.
Wow.
Holes from the points of bayonets.
Mm-hmm. And yet in the midst of that, Carl is taking off and going into the hinterlands to deal with smallpox eradication. Talk a little bit about his mission and his duties that he did daily, weekly.
Carl was passionate, and I would say thinking in terms of all of the people who were part of smallpox eradication. They were, to the very last individual, they were passionate about this job and absolutely confident that they would complete it, that they would be victorious.
There are a lot of parallels to today. I was fascinated to read about his mission of contact tracing as a critical tool.
The contact tracing was, it's part of what became known as the ring method of vaccination. It became apparent that you could not possibly vaccinate every single person in the world. For one thing, with the birth rate, the population is growing faster than you can get that done. But also, Dr. Bill Foege, who was just a giant of a man and public health hero, really, he developed this method of vaccinating based on, you find one case, and then you find you vaccinate all of the contacts of that person, and then vaccinate all of their contacts.
So that was total
and
key.
So you build a firewall around the virus.
And it worked.
Yes. Yes, right. It did.
So smallpox, directly due to Carl and his associates, was eradicated worldwide. They succeeded.
Yes. Yes, they did.
That's really cool.
And, of course, that is a different, the smallpox the variola virus is a different virus than the coronavirus. You know, there are several things about the virus itself that made it a candidate for eradication, as they referred to. There was no animal vector. It was only person-to-person transmission. The symptoms were visible, and you did not have asymptomatic transmission of the virus. And so those things contributed as well. And then in addition to the characteristics of the virus, you had consistent messaging, you know, a system that was used worldwide. And besides that, it was a different virus, but also different people. For smallpox, I'd say the rich nations knew that if you didn't vaccinate the poor nations, you were still going to be at risk. And so the rich nations had an absolute mission to also get the vaccine to the poorest nations in the world.
Interesting. So your time there, you were really sequestered for the most part in your home in town. But you were able once in a while to get a hop on a Convair 440, a 20-minute flight to a different world. Tell us about that break in your time there.
Well, as far as being sequestered, I would say you were sequestered not in the house, but the town itself, the capital city of Equatorial Guinea at that time, was about 1 square mile, right. A little over 1 square mile.
And the shops had a dearth of anything inside, right?
Right, because all of the Spaniards had been evacuated, and so there was very little market for any of these products, plus they had been plundered and so on. You know, I was not afraid to walk in the streets and in the few blocks that we had. But there was a limit as to how far you could go outside of the little town. And since we were on an island, and the only means of departure really was on the plane, it was kind of like being sequestered. Most of Carl's work was over on the mainland.
Right. Still in Equatorial Guinea.
Yes. Yeah. Equatorial Guinea consisted primarily of Rio Muni, the small mainland portion, the island of Fernando Po at that time. It's called Bioko Island now. and the tiny islet of Annabon, and all of which you could fit inside the state of Maryland and have a little wiggle room left over. So it was always just like a breath of fresh air to get on that little Convair 440, and then if it didn't skim the tops of the trees too much and you safely got to Cameroon, then you had the, you know, the music and the smiles and
what a disconnect, home. Huh?
Yes, yeah. Right.
And then you went to some governmental functions and dinners right there?
Well, yes, when you're in a tiny little country like Equatorial Guinea and, you know, there were nine embassies and diplomatic missions. But the ones that were friendly to the United States, you know, the dinners and so on, those were kind of the only social life there was. Mm-hmm. And you have 25 maybe potential people to socialize with, mm-hmm. for a while. And then with the United Nations advisors who were there.
You had Chinese and Russian embassy people there that totally iced you, right?
Yeah, we. Those were not the people we associated with.
Back to the island, I'm just seared with the memory of Charles building the bow and arrow. That he was going to take down the government. Tell us about that. He almost caused an international incident as a six-year-old.
Well, apparently, yeah, it was kind of a joke we made about that. But, yes, Charles had taken a twig and a rubber band, and he was, well, there were several. I guess he was sitting on the front porch making little bows and arrows, and there was some guardia passing the house, and he decided to shoot
the soldiers
this bow and arrow at one of them. I don't know if this was getting back at them for the day we were unpacking and they were ramming their bayonets into things, but I shouldn't tell that story too much. People need to read the book. But I did hear later, you're the mother of the little boy that nearly created an international incident.
So, well, the soldiers tried to take him prisoner, right?
They wanted to, they were pounding on the door. This is the way I heard the story from, and our steward had bolted the door and didn't let them get him. Charles had run inside the house, and mm-hmm. and Samuel had bolted the door, and they were pounding on the door saying, "Give us that boy." I better leave some mystery to this.
There you go. Okay, well, back to your daily life there. You went through a learning curve with hiring and utilizing locals to help and assist around the house. And you came in probably, I can do a lot of this, but then realizing that you were helping people and the economy by having a large staff to help you around the house. Tell us about that retinue.
Yes, I had said, well, I was not going to have servants. I could do all these things myself, and mm-hmm. I was not going to be so high and mighty as to mm-hmm. have servants. And then, you know, you discover that the people really feel resentful if you're in their country and you're rich and you're not giving their people jobs. So that, we hired the first one, but in Nigeria, at least, there was this hierarchy of the servant Well, a servant hierarchy, and you had to have various ones on this ladder because somebody higher up on the ladder expected you to hire the one below them to help them with their tasks. So, yeah, so we wound up with five staff of five in Nigeria. That was counting the watchmen that USAID hired. It just kind of developed that, oh, well, we needed to give this person this job, and, oh, now we've got to hire this one, and because the first one wants help, and you just need to give more jobs.
Yeah, interesting. So, and you created a close friendship and bond with some of these people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, it was hard to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm. And was Samuel the one you're most curious about what happened to him?
Yes, because that was in Equatorial Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
In Equatorial Guinea, we had only Samuel and who came 5 days a week, and another couple of young boys who came off and on.
Mm-hmm.
And in Nigeria is where we had the
larger
staff.
That
was where that was expected.
Mm-hmm.
But with Samuel, because of what happened in Equatorial Guinea, then that's something I still think about once in a while and wonder, did Samuel ever get out safely?
Yeah. For a moment, a little negative, but dig deeper on the atrocities that ruler of Equatorial Guinea did to the people and what the ultimate outcome, what happened to him, and what's it like now?
You know, there have been some people who have written some books about the atrocities that took place. These were not things that I ever witnessed.
Mm-hmm. But they were happening blocks away from your house.
Yes, they could have been happening across, you know, in the next alleyway or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that. But we would learn about them. And, you know, to start with, after Macias won the presidential election, he started murdering all of the people who had been his opponents in that election, and then their families, and then tribal leaders, anybody who could have some influence over
mm-hmm.
people and who he perceived to have some power because they were looked on as leaders.
And then ultimately people in his own administration, correctly?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the most dangerous places you could be was in his cabinet or be his right-hand
mm-hmm.
person, because then he would develop a distrust and feel like, you know, you were trying to take over his government or kill him or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So he was total paranoid.
He seemed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it started, you know, with people, these opponents of his, and then people of other tribes, but he kept on until he was also murdering people of his own tribe and even his own clan. And sometimes he would, if there was someone that he felt was some sort of threat to him or had insulted him, he would also kill their families. Or often these people were put in Black Beach Prison, which could be worse than death in many cases, and sometimes burned whole villages. There was a Christmas time when he reprised something he had done earlier, only this time with more victims. Seems to me that there were like 150 people that he said were plotting a coup against him, and they were executed and the at the stadium with the firing squad being dressed in Santa Claus costume for Christmas Day.
And what was the music?
Those were the days, my friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
And this happened early on, and then again that Christmas Day.
So over the loudspeaker, they would be playing Those Were the Days, my friend.
Right.
Wow. And what was the ultimate demise of Macias?
His nephew, who is still president.
Wow.
40-something years later, mm-hmm. 42 years later, is it? Obiang overthrew him.
And after you overthrew them, that's when they discovered oil there?
Yes.
And now he's got his big yacht, and yet the people are still as poor as ever.
It's,
right?
One of the things I have tried to do is keep my book focused on what
right.
was going on when we were there.
Mm-hmm. Time and place.
And there are many sources people can look to mm-hmm. and find out what's been going on since.
So why did you guys leave Africa and when? And then as I remember, Carl got stationed in the Southwest, right, with the Native American
After some period of time that... when we
why did you go back? Why did Carl leave? Because he succeeded in his mission.
We left just a little bit early mm-hmm. Because the children and I had been evacuated out of Equatorial Guinea, and we were in Cameroon, and so
because it was no longer safe for you guys to be there.
There was some concern. After they tried to, after the incident with Charles. Mm-hmm. And so we had been evacuated 4 months before moving mm-hmm. out of Africa. And it was getting close to the end of the smallpox program.
Mm-hmm.
Smallpox had been eradicated. CDC really would have preferred that we stay a little longer in all these countries for surveillance to make sure mm-hmm. that there was no smallpox left in West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But USAID, you know, they pretty much were ending. We were right on the cusp of the end of the entire West African program.
Mm-hmm.
And the smallpox eradication program in West Africa was budgeted and projected to be a 5-year program. They accomplished the goal in 3.5 years and $19 million under budget.
Wow.
So
that's really cool.
That was something they were really proud of.
Yeah.
So we left just a short while before that.
Mm-hmm.
We really did not want to leave Africa. We would have preferred to stay in mm-hmm. some country other than Equatorial Guinea.
Right. Right. Interesting. Have you did you guys ever get back to Africa after that, or that was it?
We have not. Mm-hmm. I feel a tug to go back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We did later. We lived 6 years in Saudi Arabia and have wanted to go back. Shortly before the pandemic hit, I was checking with the Peace Corps,
mm-hmm.
and I asked them what their upper age limit was. And they don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
But they said the oldest person who had ever gone with them was 86.
Oh, wow.
So I still have a couple of years.
There you go.
So I would love to go.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see when it's really safe to travel again.
Yeah. Well, let me interject for a moment, because another thing that really tugged a heartstring in me was the problems you had in cultural reentry to Western society. I remember coming back from rural Nicaragua, spending time there, and it was hard coming back.
Is.
Tell us about that disconnect.
That was really a very difficult thing. I've said I didn't have culture shock, but I sure had reverse culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you come back from a place where there are so many life and death issues every day, and you're seeing life and death issues. And, you know, whether it's from disease or violence or whatever it is, and such dire need, and come back and go into a grocery store with an aisle, an entire aisle of breakfast cereal, or how many different kinds of toothpaste. I think it's, you know, coming back into such a consumer society and feeling like the values are just upside down.
Right. Well, and again, where you came from, in some of the villages, the breadth and length of their options, their choices in their daily life was, do I walk 3 miles to bring water back to mom so she can cook or not?
Yes.
That's the extent of their luxury of options, of choices. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it is hard. And people, you know, you. Well, I'm sure we were very naive. We were young. And we thought people were going to really want to hear all the wisdom we had to share.
Right.
And you soon learn that, okay, a couple of minutes after we started talking about things in Africa, the eyes start to glaze over, and you start just kind of keeping things to yourself because people are ready for you to get back to normal, quote, unquote.
Yeah, they are such separate worlds that there's no way to make any sense or connection out of it, You have to be there. You have to go there. Interesting.
Right. As I've thought about it, especially, I guess, as I was writing the book, too, I thought about when people have suffered some great tragedy, especially, let's say, a parent whose child dies. Friends are ready for you to get back to normal long before you're able. What people regard as back to normal, and it's kind of a journey that you have to make all by yourself, I think.
Yep. If Bea Blosser was to sign up for Peace Corps, where's your number one place you would like to go?
I would like to go back to West Africa. Not to Equatorial Guinea, and at this point, not Nigeria either.
Where would you choose?
Ghana is really close there, so I've thought about Ghana quite a bit, and there are a number of volunteer opportunities in Ghana. So that's one place I think about.
What would you like to do there?
Well, I'm a retired speech-language pathologist, and of course, I couldn't do clinical work. I've let my license go now after many, many years. but I think there are ways that I could help, let's say, in a preschool for handicapped children. And there are some volunteer agencies. If not the Peace Corps, there are some shorter-term options.
So you're based in Santa Barbara, California now, right?
I am now,
Are you involved in the community at all in Santa Barbara? Groups, organizations?
Well, some groups. I arrived in Santa Barbara just a couple of months before the pandemic arrived. So I had started getting together with Toastmasters, and I had joined a little chorus and
a writer's group.
And a writer's group, yes. So I still have continued with some of those things by Zoom. And because of the pandemic, I've been able to continue to Zoom with my fellow writers back in Arizona, too.
And before we go, when you came back, we talked about Carl being assigned in the Southwest in America, right?
Oh, yes.
With Native American. What was he doing there, and where was he? Where were you?
Well, we had been on the Navajo before going to Africa. Mm-hmm. We'd been on the Navajo and then in Santa Fe, where he worked with Pueblos, the Pueblo groups at that point. Then when we came back, after he completed a master's of public health at the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston, we came back to the Navajo and were there for a short while. And then he was transferred to Sacaton, Arizona, which is the capital of the Gila River Indian community. Uh-huh. And he was there as hospital administrator. Sure. So he had done various things with Indian health mm-hmm. in those places. And
okay, one more. I can't help reeling back to Equatorial Guinea. Charles, your six-year-old son, he had a sister.
Yes.
And she seemed to be more kind of smooth and take things as they come. Tell us about her a little bit and what happened to her.
Well, she was Ginger. Mm-hmm. Yes, Ginger was just barely two
okay.
when we moved to Equatorial Guinea. Mm-hmm. So her memories, she has just little snapshots, little snippets of memory. Mm-hmm. Like the day of our unpacking, she remembers boots and legs and boxes.
Oh, funny.
And I mean, she was a little mm-hmm. bitty thing, very petite yeah. for her age even. And maybe she remembers bayonets going into boxes. But, you know, at that age, she yeah. didn't have any yeah. sort of cognitive pockets mm-hmm. in which to place those things that would make it seem threatening. So she remembers, all of her memories are very positive. She remembers being nurtured and protected and all by the people who worked in our home, mm-hmm. both in Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea. She said, you know, she thinks that Carl and I must have outwardly seemed so calm that she didn't sense, she doesn't have any memory or any sense
of fear
feeling
or, yeah.
threatened. Right.
Interesting. Oh, my gosh, B. We've got to chapter one, the intro to your life journey. What a joy. What a delight. I'm so glad we got together and that your friend Miss Green in Santa Barbara introduced us.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Betsy right. Green.
Yeah. Right. I really appreciate her, telling you about my book.
And, yeah.
And appreciate so much the opportunity to talk with you today.
My pleasure. To learn more about Vaccines and Bayonets, the new book, and your world, where would you direct a listener?
Vaccines and Bayonets, it is available through most online booksellers. And Tecolote Bookshop in Montecito, California, mm-hmm. is carrying the book as well.
In the bookstore downtown Santa Barbara?
They can order it for you as okay. well as Barnes & Noble.
I need to talk to them. They need to have it in the front window.
Yeah. Well, that's a great, thanks.
Yeah. B. Blosser, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.
I enjoyed being with you.
Me too. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been visiting with B. Blosser, the author of Vaccines and Bayonets, a historical memoir about fighting smallpox in Africa and tribalism, terror, and the Cold War. Thanks again, B.
Thank you.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard Journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.